Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 12:43 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time, and today is May 26th. And this was a very eventful week that we saw stock markets breaking out on the upside, not least the S&P 500 and the FTSE 100 in the UK, but also the Korean market has continued to push higher, but all of that has been led higher by the Nasdaq. And this week we saw, in fact, it was yesterday, Amazon got as high as $999 exactly, and just was not able to push through that additional dollar to get to that big psychological 1,000 level, and has eased back a little bit in here today. So we're not going to see that $1,000 level taken out this week. This was also a week in which Bitcoin soared to new, previously unimaginable peaks in the region of 2,800, and has subsequently come back towards that 2,000 level in the last 2 days. So there's a lot to talk about there. This was a meeting, a week in which the Fed released the minutes, and I'm going to talk about that first. But then it was also a week in which OPEC had something to say, and the oil market responded really quite abruptly. Now, what was it the Fed had to say? They said, well, that they're thinking about raising interest rates, but that some people would like to wait for some additional data. And that's important. Whether we get the Fed rate hike in June or somewhat later, that's going to be certainly a question. But the market has already largely priced in the potential for a rate hike in June. The much bigger question that I think we do need to start to think about is if the Fed is in fact intent on beginning to reduce the size of its balance sheet, what effect is that going to have on markets? We can see here that the Fed's balance sheet had been increasing at a relatively gradual pace between about 1995 and 2008, and then it took off. We can see that Ben Bernanke followed through on all those academic papers that he had written, saying that what was required in the case of a financial crisis was totally extraordinary monetary policy. And he increased the size of the Fed's balance sheet from 1 trillion to 4. And since really the beginning of 2014, it hasn't really moved at all. This is actually a very similar situation to what we had in the UK. The UK stopped publishing this data in 2014, so we can't. And we can only assume that the size of the Bank of England's balance sheet has expanded since the Brexit decision and the additional round of quantitative easing. Certainly, the deterioration of the pound over the same period of time would confirm, or at least suggest, that that has indeed been the case. But when we look at the Fed, and there will be a large argument going on about what effect it's going to have, if it indeed is going to have any effect at all, because they have said that they want to do it gradually, but they have certainly not defined what gradually means. But we do have an example of a central bank that withdrew over a trillion from its balance sheet, and that's the euro. And I've got the chart here. This is the ECB's total assets. And between about the middle of 2012 and the middle of 2014, or really three quarters of the way through 2014, the ECB withdrew €1 trillion from its balance sheet. And that had some rather profound effects on asset prices. So rather than have an argument about what it means or what is the likely potential outcome, then we have evidence. We should really just look at that. Sorry, I must go backwards, I believe. Between about the middle of 2012 and the beginning of 2014, German Bund yields moved from 1.2% to 2%. Then, from the beginning of 2014, there was this argument going on, if you remember, cast your mind back, that what was the ECB going to do? They had this problem with deflation. They were withdrawing money from the system, and it was contributing to a deflationary environment. And that might have gone down well in the German press, but it was really squeezing the life out of the peripheral economies in the Eurozone. And there was this big argument about whether Mario Draghi would be able to get his hand or get his way and be able to stamp his authority on the ECB. Well, we know what happened, that they totally abandoned their their policy of withdrawing liquidity from the market. But as long as the ECB was reducing the size of its balance sheet, what that constituted was that it was no longer reinvesting. In fact, it was selling bonds. If you have a very large buyer in any market, in any asset class, that has been buying all day, all week, all month, then they represent a stalwart within the market. But when they stop buying, well, what is that going to do? It's going to put additional pressure on the other people that want to buy to pick up the demand deficit. And quite often, considering that the central bank is one of the largest purchasers of bonds, if they stop buying, well, then it's hard for all the people that want to buy bonds to make up that deficit. But perhaps more importantly, it robs the market of the momentum traders, the people that were following on the coattails of the central bank. They stop buying too. So we had yields moving higher in Germany, and that's just Germany. I think we can all remember that there was significant pressure on a number of the peripheral country government bond yields back then, and that is why the ECB eventually had to just give up on that policy. So then we saw afterwards that yields collapsed, and in a very, very abrupt manner. Then, if we look at the euro over the same period of time, between about the middle of 2012 and the beginning of 2014, the euro went from 120 to 140. That was a substantial rally. Now, of course, no currency trades in isolation, so it obviously has to be compared with what the dollar was doing at the same time. But the fact that up until the beginning of 2014, the USA was still engaged in quantitative easing, and the ECB was engaged in quantitative tightening, well, then that represented a clear bullish outcome for the euro. But if the Fed starts to withdraw liquidity and move into quantitative tightening, and the ECB is engaged in quantitative easing, well, doesn't that then represent a bullish characteristic for the dollar? And what I find really quite interesting at present is that we don't have any evidence at all that the dollar index has found support. The dollar index is barely steady in here over the last week. It has been falling for really since the turn of the year, and it has failed to sustain the move above 100. It has pulled back into the underlying range, and it is, and I think in the absence of a clear break of that progression of lower rally highs, then we'd have to give the benefit of the doubt to the downside, that this is a failed upside break, and that the most likely scenario is that it is going to go back down and test the lower side of this range, which is currently around 22, excuse me, 92 and a half. But if we start to play it forward and think about that, if the Fed is talking about potentially beginning to change the way that it is managing the size of its balance sheet later this year, then that would suggest that the dollar is a buy on dips. Because if there is no real, I mean, Mario Draghi this week said that he didn't see any reason to change their policy right now. Certainly, Germany does not need interest rates at such low levels, and it could probably do with a stronger currency, but it is quite another question whether the rest of the Eurozone can put up with a stronger currency. In fact, I think it is not unreasonable to conclude that one of the reasons that the European economy is doing better is because the euro is so weak. And I think that that is perhaps something that has been largely ignored by the market against the background of what have been really quite favorable economic statistics coming out of the Eurozone. Well, then if we look at what happened with stocks over that same period of time, between the middle of 2012 and the middle of 2014, the stock market came off of really quite depressed levels and really did quite well. And that was also part of the period of time when the banking sector was doing reasonably well. Higher government bond yields, somewhat higher interest rates, that would have helped the European banking sector. I can pull up that chart so that we can have a look at it. If we look back between about 2012 and the middle of 2014, the banking sector was in an uptrend. So after the announcement of quantitative easing, it became considerably more difficult, for obvious reasons, that if interest rates are going to zero, if they then in, and they did then embark on negative interest rates, that's terrible news for the banking sector. So we have to consider the potential that if the Fed is going to be reducing the size of its balance sheet, that it has a deflationary outcome, and that in order to combat that deflationary outcome, they have to be absolutely convinced that that growth is well entrenched. So when they say that they're going to be engaged in reducing the size of their balance sheet, and they talk about it being gradual, it could be incredibly gradual. That they were buying bonds for years at a clip of about 40 billion for treasuries and 40 excuse me 40 billion for treasuries and 40 billion for mortgages every month. Now, if we bring up the I just need to get the ticker for the Fannie Mae. No, sorry, it's the Freddie Mac. I'm sorry about this. 30-year. So it's NMCM. Because what I think is not, I haven't seen any conversation about it at all, but the Fed owns a lot of mortgages. And right now, the mortgage rate on the Freddie Mac 30-year is 3.95%. But what happens if the Fed begins to reduce the size of its balance sheet? Then that removes a buyer of mortgages. And if the yield can rise on government bonds, it can also rise on mortgages. And right now, the yield or the rate at which one can take out a mortgage might not be back at its lows, but it is at the same place today as it was back in 2011. Now, what does that's still very attractive that one can take out a 30-year mortgage at 3.95%, and that as long as it is coming down, then you have the potential to refinance because all the mortgage, well, the vast majority of mortgages in the U.S. are fixed rate, and the government, excuse me, the housing market has been doing really very well, and that the pace of price increases has been going up about 6% nationally for the last few years, but in attractive places to live, or some of the better neighborhoods, prices have exceeded where they were in 2007. So that will also that has also been influenced by the fact that we have these low interest rates. If the Fed starts to reduce the size of its balance sheet, well, then that suggests that mortgage rates are going to go up, and that is also deflationary. Does that then suggest that the Fed is in a bind, that they may not be able to raise interest rates at all? If we look at the 2-year and look at that on the a really long term, it's at 1.3% or just less than that. If we just look at it and don't think about what in fact it is, we can see that it is at incredibly low levels historically and that the trend is upwards. But that trend upwards could be very gradual. It would be difficult for the Fed to raise interest rates and reduce the size of its balance sheet at the same time, and not least because of the effect that raising interest rates would have on the ability of the Treasury to fund itself. So a potential way that they could leave a certain amount of stimulus in the economy while also trying to remove some of the excesses that have built up because of the amount of liquidity that is sloshing around in the market, well, their answer could be to just reduce the size of their balance sheet and leave interest rates alone. That would suggest that what the bond market has been pricing in for the 2-year may in fact be correct, that we may not get a great number of interest rate hikes. And that then would also be positive for the banking sector. If the central bank is not becoming the lender of both first and last resort, then banks would be able to, if government bond yields are rising, and that would suggest that we're getting a steeper yield curve, that increases the margins of the banking sector. They would then also be able to return to the market as a liquidity provider, and I think really take up the mantle of being a liquidity provider once more. They haven't been engaged in a great deal of lending, and not least to the consumer market, for the well, really since the financial crisis. Now, the banking sector did phenomenally well in the aftermath of Trump's election back in November, but it has been largely range bound for the last 6 months, and it has now unwound the vast majority of its overbought condition relative to the trend mean. So that would suggest that there is the potential that it is going to bounce additionally from here, provided, of course, that it holds the region of the trend mean. These are, I think, medium to long-term considerations, considering that the Fed is really only beginning to talk about reducing the size of the balance sheet, and they have said already that they're not going to even begin to think about actually acting on that discussion until the latter half of this year. And when we think about the latter half, I think they're probably talking about November or December. Now, if that's the case, then if we look back at what has happened in Europe, there is the potential that that action could be positive for the stock market, because it would reduce the potential for interest rates to rise. So then we should probably look at the stock market. And when we look at the stock market, the S&P 500 broke out this week. So it, on the medium-term basis, it has held this rivetingly consistent progression of high reaction lows since early 2016, and this has been really quite a consistent advance. It is at least, if not more consistent, than that very impressive advance that we had between the end of 2012 and the beginning of 2015. And on that occasion, reversions back to the mean were pretty temporary. That we have a succession of times when it pulled back to the mean, it bounced really quite emphatically. And then we had this somewhat larger pullback, and that was the loss of consistency, something that we talk about at the chart seminar, a loss of consistency at the penultimate high. And then things started to roll over, and we moved into what was a lengthy period of ranging, which was completed immediately after the presidential election. Now, the S&P 500 has so far held this move above 2400. It has been in positive territory for the last seven sessions in a row, and we're heading into a holiday weekend. So there is the potential that if people want to take advantage of what are going to be really quite thin markets on Monday, then this would be an opportune time for enterprising computer programs to do just that. But other than that potential for some short-term volatility, we are in a benign environment overall. The VIX index came right back down to its lows today, and it is trading at, I believe it's a new all-time low at 9.56. Excuse me, it is, sorry, that was back in on the 9th of May, so it is really very close. I think the number of times that it has traded below 10, you can almost count on your hands over the entire life of the index. So volatility is very low. That is not a sustainable condition. That we have had really incredibly impressive advances. And then when we look at, for example, some of the best performing shares, that they have done spectacularly well. And I think when we just look for some of the examples, that there are genuinely good reasons for why Adobe should be going up so quickly. that it was one of the first companies to adopt a subscription model, and it has benefited enormously both from that subscription model and the growth of the internet and of online retail, because online retail is really about selling photos, and you can't run an online business without using Photoshop. That would suggest that there is a good reason for why Adobe has done so spectacularly well, but I don't think anybody can mistake that the pace of this advance has picked up considerably since the beginning of the year. There is no evidence that it's over, and it rebounded really very emphatically from that drawdown that we had last week. But eventually, this will roll over, and the first clear downward dynamic sustained beyond the very short term is going to represent a peak of at least near-term significance. Now, Nvidia gapped higher earlier on this week because, excuse me, it wasn't this week, it was 3 weeks ago, and that was as news broke that the SoftBank large technology fund has invested 4% or 4 billion of its total assets in Nvidia. So it surged higher from 100 to 140. So it is again now even more ex overextended relative to the trend mean almost than it was at its previous peak. So this is again, it's a very hot market. Autodesk is another one of these subscription-oriented companies, and it had a surprise earnings boost. And really, it is only just following in the footsteps of Adobe with its CAD software. And the other reason that I keep an eye on Autodesk is because it was one of the first movers in synthetic biology. And that might not represent any of its revenue right now, but it certainly has an active group pursuing that market with great enthusiasm. So then if we look at, for example, Amazon getting all the way up to that psychological 1,000 level and not quite surmounting it, that it is a little bit overbought in the short term. So and of course, because this is a $1,000 share, a little bit is probably a bit of an exaggeration. Or sorry, is an understatement is what I should say, because it could pull back to the trend mean, which would be $160, and still remain in an uptrend. And the last reaction low was in the region of the previous peak. So if it were to pull back to the region of the previous peak, that would now also coincide with the region of the trend mean, and that, in fact, would represent a consistency characteristic in the context of what is still an incredible uptrend. And Amazon is announcing, it's almost daily, it's announcing a new market that it wants to get into. Well, it has already taken a significant chunk out of the department store market, and Macy's is overextended on the downside, but it really does need to do something important to really indicate that the market is turning around. Ralph Lauren is another market that has just been trending lower, and part of the reason for that is because their online strategy has been an abject failure, that they charge for returns, and if you're going to buy something online and it doesn't fit, well then paying to have it to for the privilege of returning it just does not work. Under Armour is a similar story. So one there is probably an interesting way of thinking about this, is that Amazon is now the marketplace, and unless you are selling with Amazon or you have co-opted Amazon's strategy, then you are failing, and that represents the clear dominance of Amazon's power to control a large segment of the internet. And the internet is a digital space, and Amazon controls a significant piece of real estate in the digital space, and so does Google, and so does Facebook, so does Microsoft. So that is part of the reason why these companies have continued to do better. I think an important characteristic of all of these types of companies is that the energy intensity of the US economy peaked about 20 years ago. That the vast majority of demand growth for energy is coming out of the emerging markets. That at a GDP of about $25,000, I do need to go and firm up that number, so please don't quote me on it, but it is somewhere in the region of that. It's between, if my memory serves, it's either $15,000 or $25,000, that the energy intensity of the economy starts to roll over. So the what we are now seeing is that it is data is and the control of data, the ability to manipulate data, and the influence of data on our daily lives is occupying a much greater portion of global GDP growth, and that's not going to change. But it represents a clear change in how people both measure economic activity, respond to economic activity, and indeed look for work. The extractive sector no longer represents the key driver of economic activity. Technology does, but technology is inherently deflationary. The whole point of developing better and more useful, more productive pieces of technology is that they contribute to us being able to use tools more effectively so that we can get more work done in the same time. And that increases per capita productivity, but the end result of this process of both technological innovation and automation is that you need fewer people. And this is occurring at a time when there has never been more people. So this is creating a certain amount of conflict. The fact that the US economy is no longer focused on, or is no longer as strongly influenced, I think is probably the best way to think about it, by the energy price, it means that they can afford to be less engaged with the Middle East. They can afford not to have as great a military presence. Now, that's important because one of the reasons that the US has got one of the greatest militaries in the world has been to protect its energy interests. But there is the real possibility that we could have the potential for energy independence, not just in the US, but in an increasing number of countries over the next decade. That's potentially that is going to create not only an incredible change in the global economy, but it's going to create a change in the geopolitical landscape as well. Because we can look at who the superpowers are, who are the superpowers that have dominated the world in the last 100 years, and they have been either major industrial nations or they have been major energy producers, and usually one and the same. What happens if it is that the future is going to be dominated not so much by the producers of resources, but by those that can control the data flow? That is a or at least the countries that have got the most efficient technology sectors. That is perhaps the most profound change that we could have even potentially even have imagined in the last 100 years. That's represents a massive change, and it's going to create incredible flux. The countries that have got the kind of improving governance that embrace I think constitutional democracy and then really address the issues that are affecting large numbers of people, well, they have by far the greatest potential to thrive in a future environment. But the risk of having deteriorating governance is likely to increase as technology develops a greater influence on the global economy, because it enhances the ability of people to communicate. It has been very clear that in a number of countries in Africa, not least Cameroon, where the government has employed pieces of technology to cut out the internet in whole swathes of the country to avoid people communicating. Now, that is the kind of thing that can be done. But it couldn't possibly be done in larger countries. And the kind of countries that that can be done in do not represent the key engines for economic growth. But what it is a signal of is that the increasing threat that technology and communication represent for oppressive regimes. It's an enormous challenge for a country like China, where they have already set up one of the most overbearing firewalls anywhere. But they have a significant challenge because they have this question of how does one animate a large consumer base to really stoke domestic demand for goods and services while also maintaining a repressive regime. And that is something that is very, very difficult to do. And what is happening in China this year is really going to give us a very clear indication of exactly what kind of ruler Xi Jinping is. They have embarked on what has been dubbed a corruption crackdown, but it has, in large part, been a crackdown on the other side of the Communist Party. There are a large number of vacancies coming up in both the Standing Committee and in the Politburo this year. They're all going to need to be filled. And how successful Xi Jinping is at doing that is going to then give us an idea of what he will do with power if he can achieve what would in fact be the most powerful position anyone has had since Mao himself. Is he going to embrace a more forthright attitude? He's certainly very pro building a blue water navy, so he wants to be more assertive on the international front. But at the same time, is he going to be less restrictive at home? Because that is certainly something that we see with increasingly vocal voices that there is with WeChat and Alibaba and China's own technology champions that they are competing internationally, but they are also enabling massive communication, and that is very difficult to keep under wraps. So there are going to be enormous challenges, and they are being driven primarily by technology. In areas where we have improving governance and we have a rational discussion going on about how to improve the lives of normal people, then there is the potential for incredible gains in stock markets. But where governance is deteriorating, then there is the very real potential for an increasing number of despots to arise. That if you go back and read Plato's Republic, that the Greeks never anticipated that democracy was going to be a permanent condition. They really viewed it more as a transitory phase, and that it eventually gave way to tyranny. There was a report out today from Mercer talking about the need for rapid change to be brought into the global pension sector if there is going to be any hope at all that pensions are going to still be a stable sector within the next 30 years. The reality is that because we've had this dichotomy between laissez-faire economic systems coupled with social democracy, and that in a large number of countries that it has really constituted a back and forth between one and the other, which has resulted in the bargaining power of unions and workers, not least in protected sectors, working in for government, ending up with very attractive working conditions and pensions, and the private sector ending up with very little. And that also means that the private sector has to pick up an increasing load to pay all those pensions. And that is not sustainable. That when you have a condition where millennials are living from home and working in gigs. They don't have the same kind of job security that their parents had. That I saw a statistic recently that it was almost 94% of jobs created in the US in the last decade have been part-time. And that represents a massive change. So there is the real potential that we're going to have something akin to generation wars, because within the next decade, all those young people are going to be reaching family formation age. They're going to start voting, and the baby boomer generation, which has had such a dominant effect on the market, will increasingly be dying off. And it does suggest then that the millennials are going to represent an increasingly powerful element within the voting class, and that could also change what have long been viewed as untouchable subjects within the vast majority of Western administrations, that they couldn't possibly touch Social Security or indeed the healthcare system. But that is just not a priority for young people. When they can't find a job, they can't keep a job, and they can't afford to live anywhere, then they're not so much worried about, and they're on the younger side of their lives, so they're not worried about their health either. What they need is money, and that is something that is a big topic. It's going to have to get covered, but the reality is that the countries most likely to deal with those challenges are the ones that have signs of improving governance. And governance doesn't move in a straight line. It certainly tends to, in a large number of countries, to be jerky. But as long as it is trending higher, then we can probably give the benefit of the doubt that solutions will be found. When we look at some of the longer term trends, then Treasury yields are low, and if the Fed does indeed begin to reduce the size of its balance sheet, then that could be the catalyst to drive the yield higher. If that is accompanied by inflation, or is accompanied by deleveraging, then there is a potential outcome that I think a lot of people are in the bond markets are unwilling to accept that we've seen the lows, and that the potential for yields to rise is significant. Gold prices, whoops, I'm not typing very correctly. Gold prices have firmed from this $1,250 area. If we look on that medium-term chart, there is a rounding characteristic. I continue to maintain that the most important thing that has happened in gold prices over the last 5 years has been that massive reaction against the prevailing downtrend in 2016. So often after that kind of type 2 bottom, you get right-hand extension, and that is what we have been treated to. But gold prices are firming, and they have held an upward bias this year, and we're getting a little breakout from the short-term range today. And I found it interesting that Bitcoin at one point today was double the price of gold. And right now it's down $150. This has been another incredibly volatile day, and the number of cryptocurrencies is proliferating, and we're seeing enterprising young technologists just creating their own out of thin air, and the number of cryptocurrencies is at least 50 right now. and you're even having private companies talking about issuing their own cryptocurrency in substituting their potential for seeking a listing on the stock market. They believe they can raise more money in that manner than by going to the stock market. So this is a mania, and we have had some profound volatility this year, excuse me, and this year, but also this week. I really do think that we are on the cusp of a really quite significant pullback, but I find it rather difficult to trade it, considering that the volatility is $600 a day. It makes it difficult to initiate a position. I think that personally, I would rather own gold, and I already own platinum. And when we take a look at the longer term, one of the countries where governance is improving is India, and it obviously is a country that is not without its challenges, but the market is responding, and it continues to extend this move above 9,000. And South Korea is another country that really is starting to get its act together. It's gone through these corruption scandals, but the market has really taken off over the last month, and it is if a range is an explosion waiting to happen, well, this was a lengthy range, 2011 to 2017, and it is now breaking out. Samsung is in a very firm position, but LG Electronics is one of the biggest producers of computer systems, infotainment systems for the new batch of electric vehicles, and LG Chem, which is its battery arm, is going to be one of the biggest producers of batteries. It's got factories in production, or excuse me, it is manufacturing factories for lithium-ion batteries in a host of countries right now. And that would suggest that the potential for Korea to stamp its footprint on the emerging technology space is, I think, really it is probably one of the better placed countries to do that. Then, at some point, if we do indeed get inflation, then Japan is a market that could benefit enormously from that. The index is still trading below 20,000. It really does need to sustain a move above that level to confirm that the medium-term demand-dominated environment is back in the driver's seat. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I wish all the best to all of you.